Welcome back to Coast AM. So millions of Americans sustain traumatic brain injuries every single year. There's stories that we've heard in the news about veterans, about professional athletes, about children and playing sports and so forth. As a matter of fact, every 13 seconds, a concussion or a mild traumatic brain injury happens somewhere in the world. It just did, as I was saying that. So this is quite an epidemic. Yet, for someone who has this common of a problem, this common of an injury, traditional medicine sends you home. There's little to offer in the way of treatment. My guest tonight is Clark Elliott. He wants to change this. He shares his remarkable story in his book that is called The Ghost in My Brain. It's about how a concussion stole his life and how the new science of brain plasticity has helped him get it back. Clark himself is a professor of artificial intelligence, and he's going to talk to us about his understanding of how the brain works. Now, he healed his brain to help a lot of people in this similar situation. We will be coming right back. This is Lisa Garr. You're listening to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast AM. My guest tonight is Clark Elliott. He is the author of the book, The Ghost in My Brain, How a Concussion Stole My Life and How the New Science of Brain Plasticity Helped Me Get It Back. He's addressing the very common traumatic brain injury, concussion, anyone who has ever had a bump on the head but just quickly discounted it because you're mostly in a state of shock rather than a state of how am I going to deal with the swelling in my brain, the lack of memory of what happened, and all of the irritable symptoms that go along with traumatic brain injuries. Welcome to the show, Clark. Thanks for joining me.
Lisa, how good to talk to you again. Thank you for having me on.
Absolutely. Clark was on my other radio show, and we had such a great time talking about this commonality that we have together here of a brain injury. But many people listening, and as I've been throughout my book tour as well, I get a caller every show that I'm on talking about an injury that they have. Most people forget them. In your case, you had quite a memorable one. Can you share your story?
In 1999, Lisa, I was rear-ended while waiting at a stoplight. Like many of the people you mentioned, I didn't think much of it at the time, and I ignored the advice of the EMTs to go to the hospital and get checked out, and instead went on to teach my 3-hour evening class at DePaul University.
Because nothing was broken, and you went on to
Well,
teach. Wow.
as you know, that's the insidious part of concussion, Lisa, is that we look fine on the outside. And it's very hard to realize that something has happened. So I shrugged my shoulders and thought, there can't be anything wrong. I look fine. I seem to be doing okay. But even in that very first moment of impact, strange things began happening in my life. I recall that the police officer was asking for my insurance card to verify that here in Illinois that I had insurance. And I had a stack of five papers that I'd taken out of the glove box. The insurance card was in the stack of papers, but I couldn't figure out how to take the insurance card out of the papers and hand it to him. I thought, well, that's odd. Why don't I just give it to him? But I couldn't seem to manage it. And he took my driver's license instead. And when I got to class, I couldn't teach standing up. My students at DePaul University and I joked about my loopiness from the car crash. But in fact, after the class was over, I couldn't get out of the chair. I couldn't get into the hall. I couldn't figure out how to get downstairs. I had to have someone help me through the revolving door because I couldn't make sense of it. And in fact, once I got outside, even though it was a relatively small parking lot, I couldn't even find my car in it. And that began my 8-year odyssey with brain damage.
Was it just appearing that you were the nutty professor and people just helped you as usual, or were you noticing instantly that you were in trouble? Because this went on, you said 8 years.
Yes, but as you have described, this is an insidious injury. It's sometimes very difficult to understand which parts of us have gone missing. I can give you a trivial example, and then one that we spoke of before that's much more dramatic in my case. If I were to say, Lisa, could you hand me that big blue box over there in the corner? we'd know that that was an ordinary sentence construction, the big blue box.
Mm-hmm.
But if I said instead, Lisa, could you hand me that blue big box over there in the corner? We'd know that there was something wrong. We don't ordinarily say the blue big box, but
mm-hmm.
where is that syntactic preference stored? It's one of those little mysterious things that we get right in a thousand ways during the day, but when it goes missing, we don't realize it. It's just that something feels off. In a more dramatic example, in my case, under brain fatigue over the course of these 8 years, I would lose the right-hand side of my world in something like what we call neglect. So if I'm looking at a number line on a page in front of me, I could see the left-hand side, but the right-hand side would taper off into oblivion. It had no meaning for me. So if I wanted to turn right to go through a doorway, I'd have to turn around to the left. And if I were trying to think about calendar time, I might make sense of yesterday, which was on the left, but I couldn't quite figure out what tomorrow meant if it were over on the right. And yet, Lisa, if you were to ask me, Clark Elliott, how are you feeling today? I might say, well, I guess I'm okay, a little bit odd, but I couldn't articulate the fact that the right-hand side of my world was missing because the very machinery needed to know that it was missing is the machinery that's gone.
How did you realize the right-hand part of your world was missing, and what part of the brain was damaged that gave you that sensation?
We never did actually get to those details of which part exactly was it that was wrong. As you may know from your own experience with concussion, I assume that after your bike accident, you probably had MRIs and CT scans. Is that right?
Yes, and there's nothing detected.
And exactly, that is so common, is that this kind of damage is pervasive throughout the brain, but we can't see it because it's happened at the microscopic level in the synapses between neurons. Maybe there's glial cell damage. It might be damage inside the sheathing of the neurons themselves, so the signals don't get through, but we can't see it on an MRI. In my case, interestingly, even though I took 1,200 pages of notes, that's the professor in me taking all these notes over the course of my experience with brain damage, I never once wrote down that the right-hand side of my world was missing. I did note that from time to time I had trouble turning, and I could write down something like the fact that part of my world was missing, but I could never label it as the right-hand side was missing.
Okay, so for other people who have had these types of traumatic brain injuries and also mild ones, what other symptoms did you notice that was happening at the time?
Like many, Lisa, I had a whole slew of conditions. I couldn't do more than one thing at a time without freezing up. I had completely lost the ability to multitask. I would lose my balance just from thinking in an interesting processing dilemma that I used my visual system, as we all do, to stay upright. It's one of the three main balance systems. Of course, we have our inner ear, but we also use proprioceptive sense in our body, that is a motion sense in our body, to help us stay upright. And then we use our eyes. And you can see this if you stand on just one foot. Most of us will notice that the muscles on the bottom of our feet move just a little bit. But if we close our eyes, all of a sudden we may start to wobble, and we can feel the muscles on the bottom of our feet moving a great deal as we try to stay upright without mm-hmm. that balance system. And in my case, when I would use my visual system for internal visualization, such as for the symbols of thought, even trying to construct a grocery list or try to imagine something I would be doing later in the day, I would lose my balance. I had a strange inability to understand what time and calendars meant. Time meant almost nothing to me. I overnight lost my spiritual life of all things, just in the blink of an eye. Any kind of prayer life all of a sudden had no meaning at all.
Why is that? No internal dialogue?
In my case, my internal dialogue was persistent. I didn't lose it, and I wonder if you did, since you did have trouble speaking, if I'm not mistaken, and
yes.
You lost early on the ability to talk. Is that right?
Yes, I did. And that was the hardest part, which was that fear took over at that point. But I still, as many people hear when I host shows, is I flip words or I random consonants jump into words. Happens a lot.
Yes, that also, I label that word misuse in the book.
Yes.
And this was actually troubling in my professional life, and I could imagine it would be in yours as well.
Which is why I do what I do. I force myself to speak clearly with organized thoughts. Yeah, I've trained myself into this, but word misuse.
I think of a time I'm sending an email to my fellow faculty members about a tenure meeting. And in constructing the phrase tenure meeting, I paused just momentarily, and here we're talking about a sub-second pause, to think about a file where I had information about that tenure meeting stored. And the F from file interfered with my processing so that I changed meeting into feeding as I was typing it. And then feeding was automatically corrected since feeding is not ordinarily a word.
Right.
That was changed to feeling. And then as I'm about to send this email message out to my learned faculty members, I realized I'm talking about tenure feeling.
Tenure feelings. Nice.
So,
yes.
Yes. And so, as you well know, this is the insidious part of concussion, that there are a thousand ways we break down in these small, tiny ways that seem inconsequential. But taken all together, they can be so troubling and I think contribute greatly to this pervasive feeling among those with concussions that we are no longer human. We've lost that core part of us that makes us normal, ordinary human beings. And the big joke, I think, among concussives is welcome to the club of being alien, being exiled from the human race.
Yes. Well, there's other things that we, you know, that you mentioned in the book about motion sickness, never being able to sit in the back seat of a car, elevators, small confined spaces don't work, loss of equilibrium, noises, light, noise seem amplified. Multitasking is challenging unless you're in the zone for it. There, you're either in the zone or completely out of the zone. Either.
So we can laugh about this now.
It's true. I mean, you're either hyper in it or absolutely dysfunctional.
And the sad thing, though, Lisa, as you mentioned when you opened this segment of this show here, is that every 13 seconds, someone else will experience a concussion
yes.
in the United States.
Yes.
5,000 people are reporting concussions every day, leaving us now with 6 million people known in the United States to be living with the long-term effects of brain damage.
And those that don't report it because there's no point. I mean, it's one of those things that, as you mentioned, traditional medicine has little to offer in the way of treatment.
Yes, as I note in the book, over the course of 8 years, I was, sought every possible medical advantage to see if I could get better. I had MRIs, CT scans. I had been to see the best neurologists. I'd been to rehabilitation centers, physical rehabilitation. I tried acupuncture, naturopaths, the diet changes. Like you, I exercised. In my case, I was mm-hmm. not the star athlete, but I did complete marathons as I ran to try and increase the blood circulation to my brain. But I was told only, Clark Elliott, in a month you may get better. In 6 months you may see an improvement. Sometimes there's a terraced improvement in a year and sometimes in 2 years. But beyond that, you will never get better. There is no treatment. No one ever recovers. I was told that repeatedly.
Wow. Wow. That is amazing. And that does not, of course, help you when your goal is to recover. So what was your breaking point here? When did you realize that you had to find some type of a solution?
As you mentioned that, I have reminded myself to mention that for those listeners that want to follow along and are looking for resources, I should mention clarkelliott.com is the website where I do have additional resources. And after 8 years of living with these symptoms, along the way, I remember sitting in my living room reaching a point where I realized, you know, Clark, you are never going to get better. The life that you have known, the person that you used to be, is never coming back. And I reflected on the time when my own father had very gracefully faced his own death, and I thought that I must also gracefully follow in his footsteps and accept that even though my body is still living, the person that I used to be was now gone and was never coming back.
Did your children notice this? You had how many children?
Five children. And much of the time I was living as a single parent taking care of these kids, which, of course, you know, that's a blessing in some ways, and that's also a lot of work. It was difficult raising the kids as a single parent with concussion because, of course, there are just so many demands placed on us as parents.
Five children, yes.
But on the other hand, there were great blessings in having these beautiful young people in the house be so supportive.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end of 8 years, I reached a point where I couldn't go on. One of the particular stressors was related to something you had mentioned, and that's the sensory overload that's so easy to occur with concussion. And my young daughter, my three-year-old, was very, very talkative, which is natural, and she's such a wonderful and engaging person. But this constant stream of words required that I process them, and I couldn't turn the words off, so that I was required to do two things at once throughout the day. On the one hand, listen to this young child
all day,
as she spoke,
yes.
And at the same time, try to do virtually anything else. That, and then the demands of keeping my job, since I was the sole support for up to 10 people at that time,
wow.
Were just became too much. And at the end of 8 years, this was by the end of 2007, I couldn't keep quite going anymore, at least at that point. And I realized that I was going to have to at last throw in the towel.
And that meant giving over custody of your children? I mean, what was it that you meant that you saw as throwing in the towel?
It was going to be pretty dramatic. First, I would certainly lose my job. I wouldn't be able to work at all. That meant, of course, losing everyone's medical insurance. I would lose my house. I would lose custodianship of my children and probably just become a ward of the state at that point. I was getting to the point where I couldn't function at all. I used to give myself a test in the morning, Lisa, to see what sort of challenges I could take on that day. And that test was to name my five children when I would get up in the morning. And on good days, in the normal way, I could name them in about 6 seconds in the usual way. And then I knew I could take on some challenges that day. But on the difficult days, the bad days, which were becoming increasingly common at this point, it might take me more than 3 minutes to name them. And even at the end of that time, I wasn't sure by the time I had gotten to the fifth one whether I had gotten even the first one right at the same time. And in those days, I knew only to do everything to be a good father and to minimally teach my classes at the university and take on no other demands at all on those days.
Just that very, very simple techniques with no judgment on yourself as to whether you were doing it perfectly or not. That was about all you could get by with.
Yes, and it's difficult to assess who am I at this point.
Yeah.
It's, as you know, it's such a task just to put one foot after another to get through the day, that it's difficult to get a global perspective. You know, we get so wrapped up in just the day-to-day managing even the simple tasks like feeding ourselves and trying to understand what it means when someone says, I'll see you at 4:30 on Friday, and you're saying, Friday
what's
is
that?
A day of the week. That's
what's today?
Something about a sequence that Friday comes after
wow.
Thursday, and they're both days, and that wow. has something to do with the square geometric figure on a calendar.
Clark, I'm sorry to interrupt you. Let's just take a quick break here, and we will come back with your story about the ghost in my brain. This is Lisa Garr. You're listening to Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast AM. My guest is author Clark Elliott. The name of his book is The Ghost in My Brain, How a Concussion Stole His Life, and then How the New Science of Brain Plasticity Helped Him Get It Back. Clark is also an artificial intelligence professor, and he has such a fascinating story to tell about also the computer and how it works and how it actually takes on its own intelligence and how our own brain does the same thing and how it can literally regrow in many different ways. And this has a lot to do with the story. His understanding of the brain has a lot to do with his work and what we can do. If anyone listening right now has had a brain injury, a concussion, has passed out, bump on the head, and you have discounted it, yet you are suffering from many of these different symptoms that he's been talking about. Continue listening because we will address issues on how you can actually change and regrow your brain. We will be back. This is Lisa Garr. You're listening to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast AM. This is Lisa Garr. My guest, Clark Elliott, he was describing before the break about how he lost certain parts of the entire right side of his world through a traumatic brain injury that he had that was discounted through a car accident that he had. So, Clark, tell me how you, when you had that point where enough was enough, you were facing losing your job, insurance, house, children, everything, how did you find a solution?
I got lucky, Lisa.
Don't we all?
That's the best way for me to describe that.
Yeah.
You know, I had gone for 8 years seeking every possible traditional treatment and then less traditional treatments. I, you know, did practice Tai Chi for many years, which I continue to do in my life, and this worked very well.
It helped you get by.
Of my life.
Mm-hmm.
But it didn't address the root problems. And like so many people, I really had nowhere to turn. Traditional medicine was clear. Clark Elliott, you will never get better, as we mentioned earlier in the show. I read a book by Norman Doidge called The Brain That Changes Itself, a wonderful book that I can highly recommend. And in that, Dr. Doidge champions the term brain plasticity and emphasizes that our brains can reconfigure themselves if we give them a chance. I think that may be consistent with, I think you used the term brain gymnastics in your own book.
Yes, true.
And the idea of brain plasticity is that even though we may have large areas of the brain that are damaged, we have other parts of the brain that can take over functioning for those damaged parts of the brain. I digress for a minute as an AI professor that most of us don't realize how stunningly complex the human brain is.
Mm.
In the book, I talk about this processing power, and I can give a couple of anecdotes. One is this metaphor of the brain as a computer that you alluded to earlier. And one single human brain, just that 2 or 3 pounds of matter in our skulls, is roughly equivalent to 50 million desktop computers. Put this graphically, if we laid those computers end-to-end, they would stretch from Chicago to Beijing with another 3,000 miles to spare. That's a lot of processing. Or if we wanted to download a human mind as in a Star Trek-like teleporter, the amount of information that we store up there is staggering. All of those parts of us, including our body systems that construct a human mind. Well, some physicists in Leicester, England, made some estimates of how long it would take to download one human being's mind,
mm-hmm.
and everything that contribute to that. And the answer is at modern high-speed bit rates, and I believe they use the European internet rates, which are faster than ours here in the United States, it would take roughly, here's the drum roll, 13 times the known age of the universe to download one human brain.
Oh my gosh, then how do you do it in artificial intelligence then?
Well, then, as you must know, Lisa, we are just at the tip of the iceberg of understanding what a human brain is. This is a magnificent, a fabulous device that we're talking about here. So I did get lucky, and this idea of brain plasticity takes advantage of the fact that this massive processor has many, many backup systems and has staggering power that we can tap on if we can just get to it. And the idea of brain plasticity is that if we can get input from the outside world through our sensory input mechanisms into parts of the brain, even if that part of the brain has not ordinarily been used for processing those input signals, they can take over the processing of those signals and begin to fully function. And the idea here is that if we route the signals away from the damaged parts of our brain and instead flood a healthy part of the brain with those same signals as a general purpose processor, it can reconfigure itself to take over that processing. In my case, I got lucky, as I mentioned, and I, searching on the term brain plasticity, I found a woman named Donnelly Marcus, who practices just north of Chicago, and is a cognitive restructuring specialist. She uses, of all things, pencil and paper puzzles to reconfigure brains. And she immediately also referred me to her colleague, the optometrist Deborah Zielinski, who uses prescription eyeglasses also to reconfigure the brain using neurodevelopmental optometric techniques. And one last thing that I'll mention from the perspective of an AI professor is that we are primarily and wholly visual spatial beings. That is, of this massive processor just described, 30% at least, and possibly as much as 50% to 80% of our brains get involved in visual spatial processing at some point. That's what gives us such dramatic power when we use the inputs through retinal systems to reconfigure the brain. The brain is primarily a visual spatial processing device.
Oh, so that's how you can be created through AI. But back to the brain, what you call in your book, brain glasses. So that they bend the filter of light, is that how it entered into the brain certain ways?
Yes, we could think of what was done to help me is that Deborah Zielinski, using these neurodevelopmental optometric techniques, found a part of my brain that was healthy. And in my case, she used prism glasses. Now, these are ordinary glasses that you could buy at any optometry, from any optometry lab. This is the kind of glasses that people walk around on the street wearing, but they had a very special prescription. In my case, they had slight prisms built into them. And she bent the light to parts of my retina, which then changed the output through what's called the optic radiations coming out of the back of my retinas, through a different part of my brain. And we could think of this as cutting a dirt road through that healthy brain tissue. And then Donnelly Marcus used these paper and pencil brain puzzles, where I rehearsed over and over again the basics of thought, the rudimentary, elementary symbols of thought, such as squares and triangles and relationships and concepts like less than and greater than, and above and below, and belongs to and doesn't belong to. Donnelly Marcus took that dirt road and turned it back into what we might think of as a superhighway, a brain superhighway that allowed me once again to operate fully as a professor of artificial intelligence.
My goodness, through these brain glasses that basically bent the light and filtered it through the retina so that different parts of the brain are triggered by that light. And that's how, that was it. And how long did it take you to realize there was a difference?
Well, that's quite a dramatic statement I'm going to give you in a moment here. I'm glad you asked that, Lisa. First, I do want to comment at the ClarkElliott.com website that's devoted to this book. I give more than 700 scholarly references relevant to neurodevelopmental optometry, and also some references to Ruben Feuerstein's work, who has more than 1,500 scholarly references to that original work, that there is a long history of science behind both of these techniques, the cognitive restructuring and the neurodevelopmental optometry. I also give pointers to the Neuro-Optometric Rehabilitation Association, that there are many hundreds of dedicated professionals around the United States that have studied this science for many years. So
this
it's not
great.
Voodoo science. This is scholarly work. It just happens not to be very well known by the medical community.
Especially for children and so forth, it can be used for adults and children alike. Yes.
Yes, absolutely. And also, we should point out that the retinas really are part of the brain, that there are 100 million receptors coming in through each eye. And that's a staggering amount of information that we do process.
Yes, absolutely. All right, so you... Go ahead. You found these, and how long did it take you to notice there was a difference?
In the course of just the first 3 weeks of after getting my neuro-optometric glasses and beginning the brain puzzles, in that first 3 weeks, I felt this massive change flooding through my body. Lisa, I was dancing down the hallway at DePaul University as I felt my body rediscovering the world. I was like a six-month-old baby, feeling doorways again that they made sense to me after 8 years, and I could feel what it meant to walk downstairs or get some sense of what before and after meant in the real way.
Mm.
I could find the center of things again so that I could put my key in a lock without struggling. And it was just like being a baby discovering the world. And at the same time, my mind was now flooding back into this body that was resituating itself in the world. And in the course of the first week, even the first 10 days of treatment, I had a sense that this, it's like a presence was following me around about 30 feet off my right shoulder. And to be honest, Lisa, at this point, I was a little bit disturbed because up until this point, even though I had all these dramatic changes in my sensory and cognitive processing, I felt normal in that I was not delusional in any way. I just knew that I was struggling with trying to apprehend the world around me. But this was different. I thought, what is this, like almost like an apparition following me around?
Huh.
And after 2 weeks, it was about 20 feet away. And after, 3 weeks, it was about 3 feet away. It was getting closer every day. And then toward the end, every hour, it was getting closer. And then in this fabulous moment outside my hall, outside my office in the hall at DePaul University, I realized, oh, that's me returning. This is the boy that, used to love the symbol processing of mathematics, and I used to ride his bicycle up at age 11 to study physics at the University of California.
Wow.
And, sailed his boat around
11?
San Francisco Bay. 11, I was a mathematics prodigy, although I wasted it being a musician.
My
and
goodness.
I loved music so passionately. And Lisa, that guy was coming back, and I went and I sat down at my desk, and I just had tears pouring down my face, realizing this great gift that I had been given my life back.
Through these glasses.
The glasses and the puzzles. And this was after 3 weeks. And I would estimate that after that first 3 weeks, maybe a month, I was about 70% restored. And, Lisa, I'm getting mail from around the world since the book has come out. And I want to comment that just recently I had two pieces of mail from people who sought the same treatment, and they used the same words. Within just a few weeks, I am back. Those are the words, I am back. And that's exactly how it felt, like I had returned home. The ghost of who I had been was now returned.
And what was your response from your family? How did they perceive you?
Well, how kids are. It's like, yeah, dad, whatever. Of course, they're delighted. And but as a concussive, I think probably in your own case, didn't you find that you mostly didn't want to talk about it so much? You just wanted to try and get on with your life.
Well, yes, you overcompensate, you cope, and all of those things are taking place at the same time. Yes, yes, absolutely.
So, of course, it was easier on everyone else that I could now, again, be more whole. I could respond in many ways, and I didn't have to work around so many challenges each day. And in my case, it was such a godsend to be away from the constant pain. During those 8 years, if I knew I had to do something like balance my checkbook, which was very, very difficult for me, I would go over to 7-Eleven and come back with a large bag of ice, because I knew after 10 or 20 minutes of trying to balance this checkbook or do my taxes, I was going to be filling a bathtub with that ice and lying down in the ice water to try and deal with the head and the intense head and neck pain.
My goodness.
So for me, it was great to be free of that. And my heart goes out to those millions of listeners out there who may themselves or know of someone who's living with that kind
of pain. Who lives with this on a daily basis. So your advice to people who are dealing with these types of symptoms is basically either find an optometrist that emphasizes in this neurodevelopmental optometric technique. Is that what you called it?
Yes.
Or
neurodevelopmental optometric technique.
Okay. Or go to Clark Elliott's website and you can start to research some of these things on your own. What about brain scans and MRIs? Do you think that they are worthwhile? Do they show anything in the end?
Well, the first thing, of course, is that this is not a knock on MDs. As we know, Lisa, they may get a beep on their cell phone and walk into the next room and save someone's life, which is not a superpower that I have or that you have. They have so many demands, and their knowledge is so extensive about how the brain works. But it is true that traditional medicine is not always, physicians are not always aware of research in other areas. We can't know exactly what's wrong in anyone's case. But the first thing we have to say is, of course, get checked out at the hospital. Mm-hmm. I mean, you could lose your life if you don't find out if there's a blood clot in your brain, something like that. So number one, of course, go through the traditional
channels,
go to the emergency room and find out. Second, I think that in my case, and probably in many cases, there's quite a bit of damage that takes place from the brain swelling. And so it's not just the initial impact. I think that by there's this almost humorous episode by the third day after my crash, when I was taking it easy at home, but still pushing myself as a professor and as a single father. I was standing in my living room, and I was thinking, there's something wrong here. It was just bugging me, and I was determined to figure out what is it that's wrong. So I was standing there in the living room. I had sweat pouring out of my forehead, and I was so nauseous. I was afraid I was going to fall over. And finally, after 15 minutes, I realized, 6 hours earlier, I'd put my shoes on the wrong feet. It took me that long to figure it out. And I think that kind of disorientation comes after the initial accident and is damage caused by brain swelling. Mm-hmm. So probably it's a very good idea to take it very easy in the days after you get a concussion. Now, this in itself can be problematic. I remember talking with a brain injury specialist, a physician, and she said the difficulty with our young athletes is we send them, our college athletes, is we send them home and say, don't go to class because thinking can also overwork the brain at a time when you need it to rest, and don't engage in physical activities. Well, that's fine for the first few days. But now you're taking this young person whose life is the sports and the sports teams they're competing on and their classes and their friends. And by a week or 10 days, now this in itself becomes very problematic. And so this is tricky. And friends and parents need to be very supportive during this time.
And the brain goes to sleep even more that way. But I'm interested in the perspective that you have around being an artificial intelligence professor. When you said in order to download the human mind, it would take 13 times the length of the universe or the time of the universe? What did you say it was?
Well, this was a fun paper that I referred to in the book. 13 times the known age of the universe.
Age of the universe.
To download everything that could contribute to a human mental state, yes.
Okay, so if that's the case, and we have such vastness in our brain, how much are we even tapping into? So when you're told not to use the brain and just to rest, doesn't that enable it just to go completely dormant and asleep? Don't you want to reawaken it?
Well, yes, later, of course. That's true that we do want to stimulate those channels in the brain. And in Norman Doidge's new book called The Brain's Way of Healing, he talks about recovering from stroke. And also he mentions a walking therapy for Parkinson's, for example. And I think the idea there is absolutely, yes, we want parts of the brain to learn because this is the way to keep a brain healthy. You're absolutely correct.
Well,
we should also mention that there are brain cooling techniques developed, I think, for heart surgeries where they may lower someone's body temperature to as low as, I could be wrong, but it might be something like 92 degrees. But that also, in acute brain injury cases, can help reduce the swelling and reduce further damage.
Oh, but it's temporary. All right, we're going to come back. We're going to find out more about the human brain and how it's like a computer and how we can work with it in order to wake up different areas of our brains. We will be right back with my guest, Clark Elliott, after the break. This is Lisa Garr. You're listening to Coast to Coast AM.